The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
What do you think of this 200 barrier? In your experience, is that a correct assessment of the way small churches develop and then refuse to grow beyond the 200 barrier, recognizing that 200 can be 150 to 250, it's a representative number. In your experience, is it correct?
I'd say so.
You think so?
Yeah.
Your culture too? In your community?
Yeah. That's a matter of the culture.
Yeah.
The intimacy.
Yeah. The intimacy of the small church is its main attraction. Everybody knows everybody. They feel like family together. And that is the very, on the flip side of that, the other side of it is that that is the greatest hindrance to growth beyond 200. Because the moment you get beyond, far beyond 200, the intimacy is going to break down and people feel that something's going wrong with their church. It's not quite as warm and cozy as it used to be. And unconsciously, they know that, so they resist the steps that would lead to growth. I was telling the class at 12 o'clock how resistance to further growth can come across. People don't come flat out and tell you, we don't want our church to grow. Now, a few might say it that way, but most people will be more subtle. They probably haven't even got it clearly in their own minds, but they feel uncomfortable with growth. They feel uncomfortable when a lot of newcomers are in church that they don't know. I had a church secretary who had grown up in the church. Her father had been one of the founders of the church. And she was extremely efficient in one way because she knew everybody. Now, this was a fairly large church, 800 members plus minus. But she actually knew everybody in that church. She'd grown up there. She was in her mid-50s, late-50s. Had known everybody had come in through the years, knew the networks, but, yeah, right. But, you know, she'd grown up through the years in that church, and she really knew that church. So she was a tremendous source of information for me. Well, if I wanted to know who was who and what were the problems there and so forth, some of the connections. However, the other problem was that She played a very key role. She was a full-time secretary. And secretaries are awfully important in churches. They're the ones who answer the phone. They're the ones that are at the door when the pastor's away. They're the ones that either turn off newcomers or open the door to them. And she resisted the influx of newcomers, people whom she didn't know, people whose family connections were completely foreign to her. And it really unjarred her, unsettled her to think that the church was beginning to change its flavor and newcomers were added that she didn't know anything about. And that bothered her. And before I came, there had been a long period in which the church had been in rapid decline, which meant that she really did know everybody that was still there. And then the idea of turning it around and opening it to a lot of new people upset her, and I had to fight her really in a nice way, but constantly there was this tension between her vision of the church where everybody knew everybody, or at least she knew everybody, and the church that was my vision and the model I was trying to work on. Now, the resistance can come in a lot of different ways. The resistance can come in the rejection of particular recommendations, so quite often the ones that cost a little money, when consciously or unconsciously the decision makers know that this is going to be growth productive. Now let me describe a situation in the church where I was pastoring. We needed to enlarge the nursery. Now, the old-timers, and there were a lot of them in that church, and they controlled most of the money. The old-timers remembered the day when the church was jammed, it was a huge congregation, and you didn't have nurseries, because in the old days, churches didn't have nurseries. Mother stayed home in the morning, dad stayed home at night. The idea of a nursery in a church, at least in the Midwest, was just not there. You didn't have nurseries. But in the 50s, this began to develop. 60s, it gained momentum. Today, churches have nurseries. The bigger churches have nurses, paid RNs, who greet the parents when they bring the children, and everything is up to snuff. Well, we had an outdated, crowded little nursery that had been built when my predecessor was there. But it got to be a zoo. I mean, they were piling kids in there. It stunk. It was stuffy. They had a broken down air conditioner that didn't work in the summertime. It just was totally inadequate. People were not bringing their children there. Now, if you want to snuff out growth among the young couples, just keep your nursery in that condition. They're going to go to the next church down the road. So we had to enlarge the nursery and update the equipment. Now, this was going to cost money. Now, you see how the crisis began to develop. Here come the plans to enlarge the nursery and spend some thousands of dollars to do what had to be done. And without anybody saying that they were against or for growth, the issue was the allotment of money to enlarge the nursery. You see? And it took some arm twisting and some telephone calls and some pressure to get some people. Actually, the turning point was I got the vice president of the session, the consistory, his wife one time was co-opted to help in the nursery. And he had been the chief resistor to the whole thing. And we got his wife to work during a morning service in the nursery. She came out of there, her head was spinning, and she got home and she told her husband, they need a bigger nursery. So we got the bigger nursery. But you see, these are the steps that it takes. And the growth-minded pastor is going to see it, and he's going to have to pay that price. But the congregation has to pay price. And I think what we're doing, and I feel for you guys in this way, you among the few in this are among the few in this seminary who are getting growth-mindedness in a formal way. And you're not probably going to be satisfied with a small congregation forever. You're going to say, hey, what could we do with our great theology to get more people under the word? We got to, you know, Reformed theology is not equivalent to or synonymous with small, piddly little churches, which sometimes people think. Now, what does it take? Well, Wagner says here are the four prices that the pastor is going to have to pay. But there are also prices that the congregation has to pay. And I think that there's a lot to that. Let's look for a moment at this side here. Assuming responsibility, hard work, being willing to share ministry with staff and with laymen. And I think one of you had a comment on that one. And accepting the fact that there will be members you can't pastor, whose names you won't know, whose hands you won't hold all the time when they need somebody. Somebody else is going to have to do it. What's that?
That's a big price.
That's a big price.
Yeah, that's a big price. And I tell you, not only do pastors want to be super pastors and do it all, but people want it too. I know in the typical Christian Reformed church, the resistance comes right here because people want the pastor. They don't want number two. They don't want number three. They don't want the elder. They want the pastor. And when you've got a whole congregation demanding that, you can't grow beyond a certain point. None of us are supermen. And I think that a lot of times the marital breakdown in homes, pastors' homes, and the problems with pastors' kids, which are notorious, roots in the fact that the pastors are under too much pressure to do it all, and people don't want anybody else but the pastor, senior pastor. I know I had to start drawing lines. I was serving a church with a lot of people getting heart attacks, and we had 100 widows and widowers in our church, a lot of older people as well as a lot of younger people, hardly anybody in the middle. Well, you know, when you have the older group, you've got people going to the hospital all the time. the heart attacks, different operations. You get a lot of incidents of that sort of thing. And I finally had to draw a line as to what kind of surgery I would go visit for. For example, cataract surgery is a very common type of operation for older people. And usually it's one night in the hospital. If there's any complication, or if they would do two at one time, it's two nights in the hospital. Now, I finally had to draw the line. And if I knew it was cataract surgery, I didn't go. I might try to get an elder or someone to go. But, you know, you get the phone call. Well, I'm going in for surgery. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Is it an emergency? No, it's cataract. Okay. Well, what do we do? I mean, they want you to go down there. They want you to go down there. But you can't do it all. You can't. And if you're going to put all of that on your agenda in a large congregation, something else has got to give. Who's the best preacher in the Philadelphia area? Well, probably James Boyce. James Boyce has an unlisted telephone number. You try to call James Boyce sometime. Forget it. You even try to call the church office and try to get a hold of his wife. And all you can, they will not give the private telephone number. All you will get is, she'll call you. Well, you know how that goes. Huh? Well, now, in a smaller church, I mean, that would be devastating for a pastor to have an unlisted phone number. I mean, people want to be able to get hold of you day or night. People don't even like it if you have a tape recorder when you're gone. You know, Pastor Joe isn't here right now. Would you please leave the message at the tone? They don't like that. They want a live body answering the phone and preferably Pastor Joe on the other side. Now, you see, Dr. Boyce is a rancher. Okay? He has an efficient staff doing the pastoring. And he has a congregation willing to accept that kind of leadership. But a lot of churches won't. And I think that there's with a decision. It's a mutual decision. I would suggest that you also, now maybe your first church that you go out as, if you become pastors, you'll have to sort of take what you can get to begin with. But after a few years and you get that second church, you'll know more where your gifts are and what you can expect. You're going to have to look at this. Because if you're thinking in terms of growth and what's going to be needed to give the kind of leadership to move from that single cell, one pastor, one congregation, mode to a growth mode, you're going to have to get the understanding with at least the elders to begin with that they're committed to it. Or you're going to be fighting them. Now, as Wagner says in the tape, he's suggesting a book now. He has a chapter on this fellowship for the layman, and that's good. But you're not going to get them all to read it. He suggests, for example, sending key people off to one of his seminars, getting some of the literature into the congregation. But resistance can come very quickly in those areas too. And in a lot of our congregations, there's a lot of traditional, built-up resistance to the kind of growth that he's talking about. Well, any other reflections? Look over your notes. What would you like to bring up and discuss from the tape? No, I think I hear what you're saying. You're going in the direction of questioning whether this growth, perhaps exceeding that 200 barrier, really is of value to be pursued? Is that what you're asking? Well, I think what Wagner is saying is that the pastoring, the quality of pastoring, can not only be equal to the small church, but maybe even better if you have the multi-cell structure built in. You know, he was talking about this church pastored by Rick Warren. Now, I'm not sure exactly where that church is. I assume California. But he said Rick Warren's church was a big church even when they still had only 100 members. Did you catch that? And the reason was that the model that Warren was following was, even in the beginning, a big church model. In other words, it was multi-cell. It wasn't just one cozy pastor-flock relationship, but he was building into it right from the beginning what it would need to become a big church, and apparently it has succeeded in that direction. I think that this is quite important. The problem is, what do you do when you come into a church that's been there a long time and is cozily snug in a small church mode, and you've got other ideas, and either you're going to have friction or somebody's going to have to change. You'll have to change or they'll have to change. There's a problem. I think the example of Robert Schuller is a good one. Wagner refers to Schuller as the A number one example of the rancher style of pastoral leadership in America. But Robert Schuller did not begin in Garden Grove, California. He began in the Midwest. It was either Iowa or South Dakota in a small community pastoring a Reformed church where the kind of growth that he envisioned just was impossible. He was frustrated. They didn't know what this pastor had in mind, and so they parted, and he put his family in the car, and they went out to California, and he began in this theater, this open-air theater. That's how he began. But you see, in that situation, it just was impossible. Somebody had to give, so he gave by getting out. And I think that is the real crunch for many of us, that we get to the point where our church just does not want to grow, even though it might. Now the question that I thought you were raising is, do we really want to see a whole lot of these mammoth churches? Or would it be much better if we were teaching multiplication of more new churches, single cell units, one pastor, one congregation, and we would say to everybody, hey, don't let your church get beyond 200 members, but then start a daughter church. Build it right into your plan from day one, that when you get to be such a number, you're going to cordially divide. Planned daughterhood, family planning of ecclesiastical kind.
Did you hear what I'm saying?
Sure, and I think that this is where, in the Reformed and Presbyterian tradition, we have a tremendous advantage with the concept of the eldership. And the reason, in years bygone now, that some churches were able to have one pastor with tremendous membership was because they had effective, diligent, faithful, trained elders. My father has pastored churches of over 2,000 members, and he was the only full-time pastor. Those were back in the 40s, 30s and 40s. But you see, when you've got a good eldership, and each elder has a block of members that he's spiritually accountable for, and he's doing his job, you've got built into the structure lay pastors. Well, don't call them lay pastors. You've got part-time, unpaid, but diligent co-pastors. And that's the genius of the multiple eldership. But the reality is that we don't have it in our churches. We've got men who are more like trustees on a corporation board than spiritual fathers in the family of Christ. And as a result, we're having to hire staff to do what in a more ideal situation, elders might do. If I were starting over, fellows, I would shape my ministry differently in a pastoral situation and put more time into eldership training. Even at the initial levels before they are elders, but if you can teach the young men, a young men's society, get them thinking in terms of the leadership that they will be exercising in a few years, but to focus more on training the internal leadership of the church to carry out the ministry. Then, as one church I know of has on the bulletin, we have one pastor, his name is so-and-so. All of us are ministers. Now that's the Ephesians 4 model. pastors, teachers, equipping the saints for the work of ministry. And in between there, you have the elders, who are, in a sense, co-pastors with the senior minister on behalf of the total membership. Now, when you've got that structure really working, you don't have to go around hiring so many people. And I don't think paid staff can ever do what a multiple eldership functioning well can do for a church. I think the main thing for the first couple of years is teach. To teach and teach these things in a rather friendly way, but people will begin to get the message, and maybe the next round of elders that are elected will begin to show a different perception. Conscientize the membership and the eldership to the biblical responsibilities. Now, that isn't going to be an overnight change, but I don't really think there's any other solution short of revolution and schism. Because entrenched leadership's not going to roll over and play dead. They're there, they represent power and authority, and you want to give them proper respect. They are the elders, even though they may be very poor ones. But teaching.
You're saying teaching them as a group, or are you saying teaching
both
from the pulpit, the whole
both
congregation?
Yeah. You get the whole congregation a general conscientization of the biblical teaching. And then teaching your elders, organizing that session or the consistory, whatever it's called, so that things are done right, that committees are accountable, that you put gentle pressure, continual pressure, that the visits are being made. They don't just come and make some votes and go home again, but they have to be spiritually accountable for what goes on in the congregation. And sometimes just writing the agenda of the session meeting says a lot about what you expect the elders to be doing. And then of course your own leadership, as you take elders with you on visitation, you may have to take them virtually by the hand and teach them how to make a spiritual call on a person. Maybe they've never done it, scared stiff, but take them with you, and gradually, hopefully, they will learn. Then you can organize special times of retreat, and a weekend retreat, or can't do it weekends, you got to be back at church, but maybe a Friday night, Saturday kind of retreat, where you study the church order, you study various topics, you sensitize the elders to some of the spiritual issues that are current, you study a theme for the year. You can do a lot of things, but the result will be that you're getting a new kind of eldership.